and welcome back to Big Mouth, the pop culture talk show for people who think a bit too much about music, film, telly, and where they're going to store it all. I'm Andrew Harrison, and as ever, I've got Sean Pattenden, writer, illustrator, smash hits graduate, and patron of the arts, with me. Hello, Sean. How are you doing, and have you had a pleasant week?
Very pleasant, thank you.
I'm delighted to hear that. Were you cheered by the fact that the next Bond film is going to have a black female 007 in it? Did you see this?
I saw it, and yes, I am totes cheered by that. I think, yeah, about time too. Why not?
Celia Weldon in The Telegraph said it's the worst kind of virtue signalling because women and black people are apparently new and a novelty, and we haven't had this before.
Yeah, this is why we should never read The Telegraph, Andrew.
I try not to.
Yeah. She's not right, remember that.
She's not right, yeah. Apparently Lashana Lynch isn't even going to be Bond. She's going to kind of inherit the 007 thing.
She gets the mantle, she gets the magic elixir, and then she goes forth. She's a different character entirely, apparently.
Does he get made redundant or something?
He has to sign on, yeah.
He gets bounced out for inappropriate conduct.
Yes, I'm not. Yeah, I'd hope so. It's exciting, isn't it? I think it's a really good idea.
It's terribly exciting. Mm. We've got two special guests today, and the first is the legend that is Rhoda Dacher, who made her name as frontwoman with the Body Snatchers back in the glory days of Two Tone, blazing a trail for female-led music that's only now reaching fruition, you might think. She sang on Nelson Mandela. She survived the experience of making the third Specials album, the claustrophobic in a studio about the size of one we're in right now. She continues to guest on record and on stage with old Two Tone lags like Madness. She's a patron of the Music Venue Trust, and she continues to gig and record with the Low Tech 4. Welcome to Big Mouth, Rhoda. How are you doing?
I'm all right, thank you very much.
Fantastic. We're going to talk about your current work and play a tune a bit later. What do you think the two-tone sound has been so durable?
I think it's more to do with the... partly because it was taken up in America and they did third wave, as they called it. So there was a reinvigoration there. So basically, the people who should have packed it up and got jobs ended up being in bands in America and kept going, which meant that they could come back here and keep going because they still kept the hand in. And then all the people who were originally following Two Tone had their children. The children had grown up and they had disposable income to go out raving, and so they do.
There you go. I always thought it was weird, the American bands, because they all look like No Doubt. You know, they all look like punks. I'm like, no, you're missing the point. Where's the suits? Get a haircut. Where's the white socks?
You want them to smarten up, do you?
Yeah, why have you got piercings? It always seemed a bit weird to me.
Ah, well, in that case, allow me to point you in the direction of a wonderful band called The Interrupters, who, apart from Amy, the singer, who's allowed to be whoever and whatever she wants, the other guys in the band did very much follow that kind of, you know, suits, braces, smart socks, smart, you know, smart clothes, basically. They followed all of that, smart haircuts. And they've kind of broken out of it now and they're doing their own thing a bit more, but they very much followed that and they're brilliant.
Is it kind of hard to wear a nice sort of tonic suit when you're sweating yourself to death in Laguna Beach? You think that's an aspect of it?
I don't know, because Gaps manages it when he goes to America. So, no.
Fair enough. I always thought that Two Tone was the thing that kind of gave straight blokes permission to dance. You know, you'd never really been allowed before. And then you saw it getting echoed in, you know, a lot of the sort of early ravers like The Prodigy and Orbital have sampled bits of old Two Tone. Do you think there's a connection there?
Well, I mean, all music and fashion, I think, hand in hand, do go forward, reinventing themselves as they go along. But they also always take a piece from something that went before and reuse it, remodel it and regurgitate it as something new. So inevitably there will have been, the people who were in those bands were influenced by something that went before. So it's not a big surprise.
Yeah. One sort of very sad thing that happened in the world of Two Tone this year was the passing of Rankin Rodger from The Beat. I only met him once and he was brilliant. He was just a really friendly guy. And his book has only just come out as posthumously. What sort of chap was he? You were kind of in the thick of it.
He was everything that you saw. I mean, he does what it says on the tin. He was a lovely guy. And if anybody believed in peace, love and unity more than him, I'd quite like to meet them. I mean, he genuinely did believe that, and if vibes were a bit wrong, if he was somewhere and the vibes felt a bit wrong, he would just go, oh man, I've got to go, you know, it doesn't feel right here. He was a lovely man who I'm sure he did raise his voice, but I can't imagine him raising his voice.
There's a great beat with Rankin Roger album called Public Confidential that we talked about on the show a while ago that's out now. Rhoda's here throughout the show. Who else do we have, Sian?
Funny you should mention, we're also welcoming Matt Glasby, film writer for GQ, Total Film, and the author of Britpop Cinema, from Trainspotting to This Is England, a look at Britain's cinema, most recent and probably last golden moment, which has just been published. We'll talk about the book and the pros and cons of Britpop in the pictures and music a bit later. How's the British film industry now, though, Matt? That's the pressing question.
Well, that's a good question. I mean, it's always up and down, isn't it? I think we've probably polarised in recent years into really big franchises like Bond and really tiny sort of things that aren't really going to translate internationally. So the book that I've published talks about those films in the middle, which I think we're missing at the moment.
What was the last great British film that you saw?
Oh, there's a question. The last great British film I saw. Well, I saw something really promising. It was a film called Gwen, a nice, dark, sort of gothic Welsh film with beautiful landscapes. It had a kind of Thomas Hardy feel to it. Mm-hmm. So that was probably the last thing that really caught my attention.
Oh, OK. Are we back to making brilliant telly and indifferent films, you think?
Yeah, it could be. I don't think the brilliant telly's ever gone away, but I think there was certainly a period when we started getting a lot better at films in the 90s, and that's what the book looks at.
Yeah. Do you think we've exported our talent too much? They've all gone elsewhere.
Well, I think that's what happened before. I think everyone in the 80s, there wasn't an industry, so people like Alan Parker, Ridley Scott, went to America and made fantastic Hollywood films. But then I think for a little while, our Richard Curtises and our Danny Boyles stayed put in the 90s. And yeah, I don't know about now. I don't know what we need to do to bring those people back. We've got those guys, but who else?
Perhaps we'll come up with some ideas later.
Hopefully.
Yeah. On this week's show, as well as talking Britpop cinema with Matt, we'll be donning the tie-dye T-shirt of destiny to attend Sweet Harmony Rave Today. It's the Saatchi Gallery's new exhibition inspired by acid house, hardcore, warehouse parties and all the good stuff. What does it say? And are we still in the umpteenth summer of love? Plus, we'll be looking at Jim Jarmusch's new Zomcom, featuring reanimated corpses in small-town America, The Dead Don't Die, and a low-key release from Devontae Hines, a.k.a. Blood Orange. Will the laid-back electronic R&B of Angel's Pulse give you the summer vibes that you require? We're taking a week off next week because of summer holes, but don't forget to support the show on Patreon, the crowdfunding platform. Pledge us the price of a pint, i.e. £5 a month, and we'll send you every show a day early, plus the extra bit, a little additional Big Mouth for your amusement and delight. Pledge us 2 pints and we'll send you an exquisite Big Mouth mug as well, which is fine for tea, coffee or a quaint herbal brew as you align your chakra on a Monday morning. Search Patreon Big Mouth to find out more. All we are saying is buy us a pint.
So, Matt, we're going to talk about your Britpop cinema book, and here's the perfect scene setter. From that opening scene of Trainspotting, it's Iggy Pop and Lust for Life. Matt, what defines Britpop cinema for you? What made you want to write this book?
Well, I mean, it's a definition that I came up with myself. Obviously, you've got some history in defining Britpop music.
Well, I don't like to talk about it.
Well, you get a little mention there. So I'd like to say that I came up with Britpop cinema circa 2015, which is just the same sort of idea, really, that we'd looked at and grouped all this disparate music together in the sort of, you know, upbeat 90s group. And actually, there was lots of great films coming out of Britain at the time, and no one had really written that much about them. So instead, when you look at it, you start with A Shallow Grave, you get Trainspotting, The Full Monty, all this really great stuff. And it seemed to have a lot in common with the music, or at least the confidence and sort of the Britishness behind that music. So I thought it'd be interesting to look at it as a group, see what it had in common.
What surprised you about what you discovered as you dug into these films? I mean, the sort of commonalities are escapism, optimism and bright colours, and also sort of inventive, ridiculous, sort of rule-breaking cinematography. As you're digging into them, did you find things that about individual movies that you hadn't previously been aware of?
Well, I found out some things which I can't even repeat here because they're too litigious.
I know. Oh, dear.
If we're talking about the text of the film themselves, I think that's a really interesting leap. And that if you think about, I remember British films in the 80s and thinking that there was a sort of punishing factor. There was a kind of realism, people sitting around tables, everyone depressed, raininess. And suddenly,
that is true.
With Danny Boyle, actually with beginning with Four Weddings and a Funeral and then with Danny Boyle taking that baton, all of a sudden someone had brought some fun to the equation, which seemed like, you know, was verboten in British cinema of the 80s. And all of a sudden, even if some of the films were kind of throwaway, actually there was a sense that you might go and see them on a Friday night and have a good time, which I think it was a strangely revolutionary concept.
That actually is a thing that's in common with Britpop music, which was music was suddenly allowed to be and supposed to be fun.
Right.
You know, we'd come out of the miserable lumberjack shirt world of moaning grunge bands in the rainy Pacific Northwest. And then next up, it's, you know, Blair doing For Tomorrow.
Absolutely.
And,
you know,
and Pulp, that kind of thing. There is an argument, of course, that Trainspotting was actually the worst thing to happen to British cinema because it produced so many terrible imitators. You get a load of, you know, the bad ones. What do you think about that?
Well, let's not shoot down some of the greats. It's a great film and it really stands up. People that came afterwards and copied that, some of it's brilliant. I mean, stuff like Human Traffic bears a massive debt to Trainspotting and has actually also got a voice of its own. Stuff like Shooting Fish, probably not so essential. So, you know, that whenever something original and awesome comes out, there's always followers and there's all, you know, pushes people off in a different direction, I think.
What are your top recommendations? If somebody wanted to, let's say the weather turns horribly at the weekend and somebody wants to lock themselves in for a Britpop cinema weekend, what are the three or four films they, obviously Trainspotting's got to be in the, what else?
Obviously Trainspotting. I think you'd be a fool to miss Human Traffic. I love Sexy Beast. I think that's got some of the same pulse. Mm. I think 24 Hour Party People, which is a bit later than those films, but it looks back at the foundations of Manchester and Indy and it's got this really kind of wicked, playful sense to it. So those are three to start with. Shallow Grave's a great film. Yeah, that should keep you ticking over for a while.
What I thought was remarkable in the book was you managed to get a whole chapter out of Spice World, which I still haven't seen, and does seem to be, that seems to reflect the others, just as, you know, Britpop produces a load of great albums and then subsequently a massive amount of Rhoda is wincing like crazy here. You know, just as, you know, there's loads of really good Britpop music and there's loads of terrible, terrible, terrible kind of cynical cash. You know, Spice World is basically the Fat Les of Britpop cinema, isn't it?
I'm just gonna put, in my defence here, it's a third of a chapter out of Spice World. But the point stands. And I think while there were films that reflect the Britpop ethos, there were also films that reflect the Cool Britannia ethos, which is sort of desperately tired Union Jack flags, dragging out old greatest hits of Britain. And actually, I think Spice World reflects that very well.
But what's interesting is it's the asides in the book which are just absolutely fascinating. I've forgotten the All Saints were in a film. They had their own film, which is in the Spice World chapter, am I right? And things like that. It's like, that's when film went mad. We put Melanie Blatt and the other one. They're very sulky ladies. They'll be in a film. Can they act? Well, who knows?
If it actually had been proper 1965 opera, you would have had the Pulp movie and you would have had the Blair movie, all living in the same house with, who's the equivalent of Wilford Bramble? It down, you know, instead you've got bloody Keith Allen and everything.
You do have that, yeah.
There's no escape from Keith Allen. Pop culture often gets at least part of the blame for where we've kind of ended up now in the era of Brexit. And people have even told me, "You, it's your fault. You invented Britpop. Now, like, you've got Brexit. It's all down to you.
It's all the same."
And you actually have got a former loaded editor as a Brexit Party MEP. And sort of,
what?
Yeah. That guy Daubney, absolutely atrocious individual, is a Brexit Party MEP now, peacocking around like Nick Moran in some kind of gang. Something. He's a loathsome figure. Do you think that kind of Michael Caine worship led to this idea of British exceptionalism? And did Britpop cinema play a part in driving Britain bonkers?
Well, I don't have the answer to that one. I will say there is a degree of stickiness with bringing in a book celebrating Britpop cinema at this time, because there's the inference that you must think that things haven't moved on since then, or that there's a kind of make Britain great aspect, which there just isn't at all. This is just the films of my teenage years looked back at with a fresh eye. But I mean, certainly there's something in common. I mean, there's the flip side of thinking that we've got stories to tell and stories that are important is people think overinflating the importance of those stories.
Yeah, and banging on about the bloody war all the time instead of what they should be banging on about, which is raves and red pony shirts and things like that. One thing you say in the book is you think it's the last British movie era, called the last big moment. Could we have another one? Could we have other? You know, we're sort of moving to almost a post-Britishness as Brexit chews up all the good stuff about the past. past.
Could we financially? I don't know. But could we practically? Absolutely. And the problem with looking back at a golden age is that you imply that there isn't going to be another one.
Yeah.
And it's just because, you know, it was great and you were 17. Well, no. I think there's always good stuff coming out, as you find out on this podcast. And so there'll be one around the corner. It just won't look the same. And I'll be too old to spot it.
Yeah, we'll be too bloody old for it. Well, in the extra bit for Patreon backers later, we've got to choose our favourite Britpop cinema movies. So hold tight for that, Patreon backers. Matt, you're doing a talk at the BFI, aren't you, about Trainspotting?
Yes, that's right. Two talks, actually. I'm introducing the film on Monday the 22nd, so that's Monday night. Mm-hmm. And then on the 12th of August, I'm going to talk through more generally about escapism, Britpop cinema, writing the book. And that's on the 12th of August, around 7 o'clock.
Are you going to do your introduction in full Trainspotting Catboy with Raj?
I think my skinny fit T-shirt days are gone. But I was, maybe there were some accents. We'll see how the land lies.
OK, that always goes down really, really well, especially if you've got Scottish people in the audience.
Definitely.
Now, never let it be said we're in thrall to the past. No. Let's go back even further to 1988 and all that with the Saatchi Gallery's rave-inspired exhibition, Sweet Harmony, Rave Today. Clues in the title. It promises an immersive retrospective exhibition devoted to presenting a revolutionary survey of rave culture through the voices and lenses of those who experienced it. Cheryl Garrett, ex-editor of The Face, is one of the people who've helped curate the exhibition, but does it bring back the heady aromas of 40,000 people dancing to Homeboy Hippie and a Funky Dread off their ruddy nut in a car park with no proper toilets? And what's an elevated rotating upside-down car got to do with anything? Let's find out after a suitable mood setter, one chosen by our resident Billy Anfield, Andrew Harrison. Nish, clash, banging, sorted. Here's the future sound of London with Expander. Rhoda, I heard you sigh just there about the car. Underneath the houndstooth, were you a secret raver?
Was I a secret raver? Well, I mean, I was... I did a bit. I mean, to be honest...
What's
I'm not,
a bit?
Well, I'm not good if there are no proper toilets, to be honest.
Okay,
you know, so if there are no proper facilities, I'm not very good. I did, for a while, live in the Midlands, so I have experienced the idea of getting a flyer, driving to Cowley Services on the M69, and then getting the phone call, and then driving into Birmingham in a long convoy, finding the room, and then and hearing the whole thing power up.
Mm-hmm.
I was probably a bit late to the party, you know, because I was a grown up. but it was the time when Adamski's Killer was the big tune, and that's what the rave opened to. And I just thought, if you're starting with this, it's going to be good.
I see.
You know, so yeah, I did a bit of that.
Okay.
Yeah, I drove people around because I was, I was the only one with a car.
Designated driver.
designated driver. Well, yeah, designated driver. Also because I don't drink, so yes, I was a designated driver, but that's fine, But also designated dancer,
We're
all right.
Okay.
Yeah.
So what were you expecting from this? And what did you think the first couple of rooms? We're not quite into the experience when we go into the gallery, but it's being set up.
What was I expecting from it? I don't know. I mean, I was two things really fascinated me. One was the beetle that was in a glass case. I don't think it was meant to be there, but I was just thinking to myself, should I tell them that it's going to eat all the stuff that's in there? I thought, no, I'm not going to.
Well, there's a live beetle in one of the cases of
Beverly.
That I missed. That might have been a special one-off VIP appearance.
So to explain to anyone who hasn't seen the exhibition, there are lots of flyers, aren't there, and sort of tiny bits of paper that could be easily destroyed by a mutant beetle.
Yes, exactly. Okay. But this was actually a glass case, so this was stuff that you weren't even supposed to touch. It was encased in glass, and there was a beetle in there. And I didn't tell them simply because I'm in Tory territory. I had to basically, in my mind, cross a picket line to go into the Saatchi Gallery.
Oh.
I never do anything Saatchi because they're Tory. They're Tory.
Because the ravers are, Paul Staines of now Guido Fox is a former rave promoter, so there's a lot of sort of that involved, entrepreneurialism.
Yeah, I know. No, I appreciate it. And that's all cool. And, the raves I went to, I really enjoyed. I mean, I just enjoyed the kind of energy of the situation. And then you go into this and it's like lots of pictures of people in fields and you, okay, you know. And that was, if I'm honest, the car... Who the hell drove a Lotus back then, exactly?
Well, one of the exhibits that you see is a Lotus upside down. Revolving while a new piece of music by Milo plays through.
That's right. Yeah. And I've put it on the Instagram page, people, if you want to see it in real life.
I quite like that, actually. Mm. I liked the odd incongruity and the mad foolishness of putting an upside down car in an exhibition.
Well, yeah, as a piece of art, of moving sculpture, yes, it was absolutely fine. But I mean, then I was thinking about, hang on, what's the point of this? And I looked at it and thought, It's not a car that anybody I knew or any of... I never saw a car like that arrive at a rave. So I'm just thinking, you know, that's kind of a weird take on it. And then I looked at a lot of pictures and it's okay. There were some interesting things, but essentially, you know, what really, really drew me in was the music, was like all the Spotify, opportunities.
There's a fake record shop, a fake real record shop in the middle, with actually selling records.
Yeah. Oh, could you buy them? There's someone DJing behind there, and there's record racks. So I was looking through them, but I mean, it just wasn't making eye contact.
It's a mixture of newly commissioned artworks and memorabilia, isn't it? So there's kind of Perspex petrol pumps signifying the beginning of the evening, which I really
I
loved.
That. I liked that a lot. That was art. I thought, okay, it's art. I'm seeing art. I was ready to see art. I wasn't really ready to see somebody's flyer collection.
Yeah. So I found both those sides really interesting because I was looking at things, had I gone to that?
You know? Yeah. Now, Matt, you've carved yourself out to be a bit of a Britpop guy, but are you a secret Spiral Tribe guy?
Well, I'm a tiny bit too young for this scene.
Yeah.
And also nowhere near cool enough to have got myself together by the time. So my recollection of the scene was by the time it got into clubs and was much more organised. Yeah. So I don't remember, but this aspect of it. I did love the approach. I loved the lit up petrol station with all the numbers on it. And then you get into a completely dark room and there's a big fence and a sort of way in. And it took me quite some time to try and work out you have to go through the fence.
Yeah.
And so things like that, those were really nice touches. Then a lot of photographs, like you say. Mm. There's something to be said for those. I loved, there was a lady called, what's her name?
Vinka Peterson, wasn't it?
Vinka Peterson. And she has a wall diary.
That was Diary of a Teenage Raver. And there was something about that sort of breathlessness. Got off with so-and-so, went to Holland, did all this stuff.
It's all handwritten, isn't it? My favourite bit was like, after all these amazing raves she'd been to, it's like, December 1993, got pleurisy. Down with the people.
But there was a dizzying level of information there. And also, it was weird. It was like someone's come up and talked to you and just chewed your ear off going, then I did this and then I did that. And then, and that felt very authentic to me.
Andrew, I'm imagining that you were having a go on the Roland 303s, which were scattered around one of the room, which also had the Spotify playlists on it, the Rode mentioned.
There's a bank of Spotify playlists, but genre by genre. There's a Make Your Own Acids PlayStation set up with 303s and 808s. You can sit there and twiddle the knobs. I realise quite hard to make decent acid house.
I made a good one. I sent you the field recording, but the recording's not so good.
Yeah, just a lot of clatteriness.
Quite a good go on that 303.
I really, really like the mixture of newly commissioned art with memorabilia. I thought that there's a kind of an installation based around, I think Seth Troxler has done the music, and it's kind of, you're surrounded by screens with flickering images only of nature, only of trees and twigs and leaves and all the rest of it. Summoning up the sense of being lost in a bush. Who hasn't wanted to be lost in a bush surrounded by dry ice and lasers? There's a kind of a hammocky thing in which TV screens are laying where human beings ought to be, and the TV screens, I thought very amusingly, are producing some very, very retro fractal art, man. Remember the fractal art of the 80s and the 90s?
Magic eye,
because you know what? They can do it on computers now. They can create images on computers. Mind-blowing. So there's a lot of that. A lot of magic eyes, man. I thought that tied in really well with the flyers, all of which contain like a kind of early computer graphics. Ooh, look, it's a robot. You might meet a robot if you go to this motorway service station. And I love NAF futurism. There's lots of bit of 2000 AD comic staple. All of that. I love NAF futurism. I love people that early days of Wired. Look, we've made a 3D wireframe banana, and it costs 40 million quid. Isn't that amazing? because it was amazing and it was looking to the future, and that beautiful optimism and excitement and colour and stupidity of it, I think, was really, really affecting.
Rhoda is killing herself laughing here, if you can hear.
I'm not disagreeing with you. That's the thing. I'm actually not disagreeing with you. I mean, the fact is, if we, you know, to sort of bring in Britpop, I mean, this whole thing, there was naff futurism in the 60s.
Yeah.
And then that was kind of what that was built on. I mean, the Jetsons, you know.
Orange and everything.
I never saw that. It was a naughty film.
But you understand the iconography, don't you? You understand the sculptures and the globulousness of the artifacts around the home, all that kind of stuff. So, yeah, I mean, I that was what I really enjoyed. What I find a bit difficult with the study of rave is when it becomes, you know, rave studies 101 and a bit of chin stroking.
Yeah.
But thankfully, it was less of that than there was of the kind of ebullience and silliness.
What I thought was really good about it is it's not about celebrity. So you've got the bloody Pete Tong Spotify, but actually you've got loads of them. And you're almost expecting from the, they've got their own flyer, the Saatchi, that's going to be the beloved, the Sweet Harmony bit drew me to that. You're going to see the Happy Mondays in a picture. You're not. It's about power to the people. Mm. It's about people turning up at these things. And I thought that was really good. And yet I agree with Rhoda. I just feel a bit funny about it being at the Saatchi Gallery. I think the two things don't mix. And it seemed maybe more of a museum piece than an art show. As you're saying, the display of memorabilia is really what it's about.
Yeah, so it's been shown to people who didn't really participate. And a lot of the people around me on that when I went to see it were sort of King's Road sort of cultural explorers, shall we say.
Oh, it was school kids when I went.
They
didn't understand at all.
I do think it falls a little bit short on, you know, as experiences go, we are now used to secret cinema and, you know, punch drunk theatre levels of verisimilitude, and just putting up a little tiny fence doesn't really cut it. It'd be better if they hadn't bothered. But I was amused by the gigantic psychedelic bouncy castle that's been taken around the world to bring some joy into the lives of underprivileged children in war-torn parts there. I loved it. I thought it was beautiful. But what I especially loved was the little sign saying, do not jump on the bouncy castle.
I know.
That's art versus commerce right
there. It wasn't
there.
As immersive as they said it might be.
It wasn't immersive at all. I mean, it was somebody looking through it, looking at it through a kind of a sterilised lens. But, I mean, I have to say, when they wanted to stamp my hand to go in, I did refuse. They said, we have to stamp your hand. I said, why?
It's a rave, Rhoda.
You're meant to stamp my hand. It's like, what are you joking? I want to stamp my hand. So I said, no. They said, why do you have to do that? Well, we can put it on a piece of paper. I said, you better do that then. They put it on a piece of paper. I went in. I desperately was looking around to see if there was another person of colour in there, because sometimes those are the sort of things that the Saatchi Gallery. You know, are you used to black people coming in here at all? And no is the answer, because I was asked to show my ticket when nobody else was.
Oh, really?
As I went from one part to another. So, yes, you know, good old Saatchi. Okay. Yes, you came home with everything I expected. Yeah, well.
So apart from Rhoda, anyone else would recommend this to a friend?
I enjoyed it. I mean, I think if you're an old raver, you'll get an awful lot of recognition factor out of this. Oh. I did see a fair few youths in there being amused by it and kind of, did you really do that? I actually saw a family where mum and dad was showing the daughter, look, we did this. But we definitely didn't do any drugs. Of course you didn't.
Yeah,
it's worth going to, but I do think that there's kind of the major historical statement is perhaps yet to be done.
Did you see anyone you knew in the photos? Because that's what I was looking for.
I was looking very hard. I actually didn't. Yeah. There's a lot of people who look like people I knew, but unfortunately.
Oh, I did see someone I think.
Good Lord.
But it went on as far as the recent...
up to Extinction Rebellion.
Yeah, exactly. So I did see, there was demos that I was on that I actually saw. And you kind of think, hang on a minute, that's up to date. That was kind of a bit weird.
Absolutely.
But the music is the most important thing.
Right.
Well, speaking of music, that was Rhoda talking, and we're going to talk a little bit about her current work with the Low Tech Four and her glorious, illustrious history in the world of two-tone. Rhoda, if the Body Snatchers turned up now, they'd be straight in the front of Graz here, wouldn't they? It would be like, this is the new strong woman pop music. Here we go. Were the press a bit unfair to you back in the day?
I don't really remember them being unfair to us. I mean, I think there was, I think, one of our first pieces in Sounds, there was a... They took a picture of me with a fisheye lens and underneath put the very lovely Rhoda. And you kind of think, okay, you're taking the what's name a bit. But I mean, I didn't mind, you know, but it was kind of like that. Because there were seven of us, because we all turned up en masse, because we shouted until we got what we wanted, we didn't really, you didn't really notice what how it could have been, you know. So I think because it's fairly strong personalities and we did have this policy of minimum of two people for any interview. People couldn't be interviewed by themselves. I'll say no more about that.
That's but you know, just okay.
It was about making sure that the message got across and that people didn't get to grind their own axes, if as it were.
Okay.
I mean, yeah. I won't talk about the legendary spare rib interview, but anyway, we didn't. I don't know on reflection how we got treated. It didn't seem that bad, but then what did I have to compare it with?
Yeah. You didn't, as the Body Snatchers were a going concern, you didn't actually get round to recording a full album, but you recorded the Body Snatchers album yourself a couple of years ago, the last album.
Five years ago.
Yeah. God, time flies by.
Yeah.
What did you do that?
Why did I do it? Yeah. I did it because people ask me about once a month. When are you going to do it? Oh, there's never... Why don't you do the album? I mean, the two things they say that I hated was, one, when are you going to get the girls back together? So, first of all, it's like... The women, I think, is what you mean. And then the second was, you know, when are you going to record an album? So I did that. It was the 35th anniversary of Two Tone. I thought, what can I do? Because I marked the 30th by doing music that had influenced Two Tone. And then so the 35th, I thought, well, let's redo the album and then maybe they'll leave me alone. That's why I did it. I mean, there are plans to do a relaunch with some extra tracks for the 40th as well. So,
Famously, you're on the Specials' third great but quite an ordeal album in the studio, aren't you? The one that seemed to take forever. Was it a bit of an odd? That seems quite quick compared by today's on a Stone Roses contemporary timetable. That's not very long, is it? Was it a bit of an ordeal?
Yes, it was a lot of an ordeal. Yeah, it was. I mean, it wasn't fun. I'm trying desperately to remember. There must have been a fun point, but I can't actually put my finger on one. I've never listened to the album.
Have you?
No,
it's quite good, you know.
I'll never know.
There's
one or two tracks I can bear. But I can't listen to it. It's just the horror. I think because I ended that, the last recording session was me sitting on the floor weeping, saying, I can't sing that line again. A taxi was called, I left and I never went back.
Good Lord. Yeah. Well, you know, if you can stomach it and get a stiff drink down here, but it is a good record. And songs like Racist Friend are actually they're very now. I mean...
They are, but you know, it's all a bit, you know, you mustn't talk to your mum, you mustn't talk to your friends or your mum and dad. And I didn't write the lyrics, so you mustn't talk to your friends or your mum and dad and just don't ever have anything to do with them again. Well, actually, dialogue is what changes people's minds, not just ignoring them or sticking them under the stairs, you know.
You DJ a lot and you tour with the Low Tech Four. Tell us what the Low Tech Four are all about.
Well, the Low Tech Four is just the current name for the band. So always name your band after your latest album. I tour. We haven't done much this year, but, hopefully we'll be on the road a bit more next year. Yeah, well, I mean, I'm still writing, I'm still recording, I still want to put music out there, I've still got something to say. It's just about finding the happy medium, trying to really find the vein of what I want to say. So it's all, you know, ideas are disparate, but I mean, that's okay. We're finding our way musically, and that's kind of what you have to do with a bit of what went before, a bit of reinvention of what went before and new stuff, which is some of it is like the old stuff, some of it's completely different. I mean, at Christmas we did a gig where we were our own support. So our first set was all the tunes that we can't normally play in our kind of a more high energy set. So it was all the kind of down tempo stuff and the jazzy stuff. So we did that as our support set. And then we did our more kind of high energy set as the headliner. So that was kind of weird.
We're going to play a track now. This is Comfort Zone. What's this all about?
Comfort Zone. It's actually a tune that I wrote a long time ago and just have redone it. This is like the third reincarnation of this tune. And it kind of does, like, you know, there's a nod to acid jazz in there and things like that. It's just about, I don't know, Comfort Zone. It's about I don't even think I know. I can't remember. I know there was an intention in the first place, but as time goes on, I suppose it's about dreaming and about finding your own space.
Well, here it is from Rhoda's latest album with the Low Tech 4. This is Comfort Zone. With music, Devontae Hines, aka Blood Orange, seems to work at a Prince-like rate, recording continuously and releasing only bits of what he makes as appendixes to the proper releases after the proper album has come out. Do you see how it works? Now he's decided to put it all out anyway in the form of a mixtape that isn't really an album and yet somehow is. What's going on in the world of the artist formerly known as Lightspeed Champion, now co-writer for ASAP Rocky, Carly Rae Jepsen, Blondie and Kylie? Here's the first track from this mixtape. It's called I Wanna See You. I see you running. I Want to See You with a C and a U from Angel's Pulse by Blood Orange. Evidently, working like Prince means you've got to spell like Prince as well. Rhoda, what did you think of Blood Orange? Have you been following him? Are you on top of him?
I wouldn't say I was following him, but then when I read a bit and I was like, he's done this, he's done that. I mean, I was, you know, very impressed with all the kind of collabs and stuff. And I mean, I've heard of all the people, which was pretty good for somebody of my advanced years. it was like ambient music. It was the music you listen to in the chill out room at the rave. You know,
it's very
much
the post-Frank Ocean world of floaty, unstructured R&B, isn't it? Electronic textures.
Yes, it was. I mean, and in that respect, I really enjoyed it. I wouldn't say I loved it, but I really enjoyed it. And I listened to it while I was doing stuff, because it wasn't the kind of music that demanded your full attention, I didn't feel.
Yeah, you sort of get the idea that you're sort of wandering through his memory palace a bit, don't you? It's half an idea. And I really like the fact that everything's like a minute and a half, or, you know, the longest thing's like 3 minutes or something, isn't it? And things sort of cut off abruptly and you're into something else. It does feel like, he's right to call it a mixtape in that it's not a big, coherent, finished thing. I mean, do you stay on top of, you know, the world of this kind of stuff, you know, the way that kind of, you know, Black American music and Black British music have kind of absorbed avant-garde electronics as well as the sort of Sony tradition?
Well, through the medium of my son, the DJ, the DJ French Hamilton, part one half of Sue Kessa, the house DJ. I mean, essentially, through him, I hear a lot of new stuff and have done for a long time, which is how I found myself in Shangri-La at Glastonbury this year, listening to Archie Hamilton. You know, and being surrounded by people who were all at least 20 years younger than me. And I did feel for a moment, I thought, oh, I actually know who this guy is. I know that tune. Then when he played a tune, I was like, oh, yeah, I know this one. I know, you know, so it's kind of weird. It's a weird space to be in. I mean, I am really into new music. I love music and I love new music. So I love new challenges. So, yes, 2 years ago at Glastonbury, I was BB, you know, Boy Better Know was the best thing for me at Glastonbury 2017, closely followed by Kano. So, yeah, I love grime because it feels like punk. It has a black element in that there's the thing that matters to black people is, you know, kind of how you look a lot more. So it wasn't dirty. It was like it's very clean, very fashionable, very stylish, very cutting edge. But I mean, that's always been fashion. It's always been the two. You know, I just feel like you know, black style and the LGBT community, but basically gay men and black men have been the forerunners of kind of style quite often in British culture.
So your top tip is have a kid 20-odd years ago and make sure he turns out to be a DJ. Then you'll always be on top of things.
Yeah.
What have I done wrong? Matt, what did you... What
I've ticked that one off. I can
well,
do this.
Well, there you go.
Now,
yeah, yeah, you're working on it. Yeah. Matt, what did you think of Angels Pulse by Blood Orange?
Well, I mean, to start with, I was really enjoying it, actually, walking around. It's summer. It's got this lovely sort of summery, synthy, slightly sketchy feel, like you mm-hmm. can't really pin it down. So I thought, oh, this is great. Actually, I'm going to really enjoy having a few listens to this. And then as it goes on, as you said, it is sketchy. They are half finished. And nothing really rises above a certain kind of tempo. And so what... Do you have? You may not have this, but do you have an album that whenever anyone comes around, you know it's safe? Mm. You put that on if they like music, if they don't
oh,
like music.
Yeah, so I would like if anybody ever came to visit me, I would, but they never do. So yeah, but
it changes throughout the era. So like you go back 15 years and it's Massive Attack. Nobody hates it. It's not too downbeat. It's not too upbeat. This sort of felt like that to me. I thought like I don't know anyone that I could put this on and they go, "What the hell is that?" in a bad way. But equally, I don't know anyone that it would blow their mind. Mm. So sort of. I mean, pleasant background listening, that seems like I'm damning with faint praise, but...
But the irony is, it's actually, there's some quite sort of strong political statements here about church bombings in Birmingham. There's some strong material here, but it's sort of in this kind of hazy, semi-distant sort of soup of stuff.
But that's, so Birmingham's track five is quite a while before mm-hmm. a voice, that distinct voice, her distinct voice comes through and you can actually imagine that the song's about something. That's what I was getting anyway. It took me really ages to think that there was something more going on.
One of the things I liked about it was in a world where every record is kind of brutally driven to provide a load of singles, you know, because pop is now, you know, if it's not a single, you almost might as well not bother with it. I liked the kind of, you know, dogged, bloody-minded refusal to have any songs in these songs. You know, it struck me as kind of, if you took, it's a really short thing as well, it's about half an hour long. Mm. If you took these, what are they, 14 tracks, and sprinkled them in the middle of a playlist of something else, then you actually would have what it's really for, which is to be just a little mind diversion before you go back to concentrate on things. Sean, what did you think?
I mean, I agree. In some senses, the song is just getting going and you've got the hook and it stops. And you think, oh, what are we doing? It's like Sufjan Stevens and Kendrick Lamar together in a kind of indie rap way. It's a very polite sort of sounding at first, but it's got that beautiful Kendrick Lamar string bed. I swear that Gold Teeth, which I really love on the album, has the same string bed chords as Pacific State by 808 State. So I was ending up singing that over the top in my kitchen like Rhoda, I did lots of things while listening to it. You can almost forget it's going on, the same thing. One of my points, though, is that the problem is it going on in the background is the mind wanders. And there's a point, and especially in a song called Happiness, where his range is so similar to Jermaine Stewart's of We Don't Have to Take Our Clothes Off fame. I could not get Jermaine Stewart out of my head and thinking, he doesn't want this. Jermaine Stewart, naff. 80s, and this is someone who's deeply cool. But yes, the mind is going all sorts of places, but I love the fact it's a mixtape. I love the fact it's not an album, and it's thoughts and it's notes and things, and I thought that was absolutely bloody incredible. More people maybe should go down that route. It just sounds so much more refreshing.
Yeah, I think people should be made to do this.
Yeah.
I would like to hear, you know, the notebooks of interesting artists.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I'd like to.
And not in a demo-y way, where you hear the intro kept being done again to get it right.
A song you like played badly.
Yeah.
Special edition, a CD of all the songs you like.
But this is a stream of consciousness way of working. Yeah. And I really like the style of it.
There we go. Yeah. Well, listen up, pop stars. Do more of this. And it's only half an hour.
It's got a nice cello on it as well. You hear all this stuff if you keep listening to it.
Oh, you've got to love a cello.
Oh, lovely bit of cello.
Okay, if you like Big Mouth, we've got another podcast you might like. Be There with Dali Loudspeakers. It's all about the minds behind the music, and we produce it in collaboration with Dali, who make absolutely amazing speakers that look beautiful and sound beyond description. There's a new episode out this week, and Sean is on it, as well as Big Mouth regular Sophie Harris. Ooh. We're talking about our favourite few nanoseconds of pop, those tiny little moments that absolutely blow your mind, plus our studio heroes. And here's a snippet of Sophie talking about hearing her favourite album of all time properly for the first time through those fantastic Dali speakers. The record is the White Album by upcoming Liverpool combo The Beatles. Who they, yes. Guitars are on the way out. Search Be There with Dali on your favourite podcast app to get the full show. And don't forget to subscribe.
I mean, I wasn't surprised because I knew the speakers were going to be amazing and it's a mind-blowing album. But yeah, it was wonderful to hear it that way. And actually, what was interesting from a kind of geeky point of view is that I've listened to it on really lovely headphones. But it's just not a headphones album in that way. And listening to it on the speakers, because the speakers work with the space that's in the room, there's a certain degree of like isolation of each of the elements that I loved. I think we all really noticed as well the way that the drums came out and that they're kind of quite crispy and middly in a really interesting
way. Yeah, they don't boom and wallop, do they?
No, they don't boom and wallop. In my kind of fantasy world, what I loved listening to about it on proper speakers is I felt a bit like I was in the control room. Like, it's as close as you're going to get to being in the control room, going, oh, yeah, a little bit higher in the mix, Paul. Is that, you know?
Friend of the show, Sophie Harris there. Search Be There with Dali on your app or on the old-fashioned internet, if you'd like, to get the full show. And don't forget to subscribe. Right, moving on. We always ask our guests to bring in a tune to inspire and sometimes terrify the listeners. Matt Glasby, what have you got for us?
I've picked Sisyphus, which is the opening track from Andrew Bird's new album, My Finest Work Yet.
We've had this on the show before, actually. Somebody else chose this. Tell us about Andrew Bird and why he's interesting.
He's a Detroit multi-instrumentalist, but much more fun than that sounds. and I've been a fan for probably since about the turn of the millennium, when he used to come over and play concerts. And the thing is, he writes great songs, so that's all there. But you see him live, and back in the day, before he had a band, he would play the violin, he would whistle, he would play a glockenspiel, play guitar and sing. He's got a beautiful voice, and he'd loop himself. So you'd hear this amazing band live, all five instruments played by the same guy. And anyone who sees him live is a fan for life, even if they don't love the albums. But actually, the albums are great. So
he's quite literate as well, isn't he? I mean, this is not the only track that alludes to myth, memory, literature, books and stuff.
So he's been accused of being precious, which I think people, you know, you could argue that case. But also, it's quite nice to have something which has got wordplay. It's got a kind of cryptic crossword feel to it. It's not all about, you know, boy meets girl and emotions. There's, you know, he's talking about Sisyphus. Whenever you ever heard the word more, M-A-W, in a pop song? I mean, I love this stuff. So bring it on.
Yeah, let's have a listen. This is Sisyphus by Andrew Bird.
Sisyphus, peered into the mist, a stone's throw from the precipice, pause. Did he jump or did he fall as he gazed into the morning mist? Did he raise both fists and say to hell with this majest? Let the rock roll. Let it go.
Finally, the movies. Jim Jarmusch is the godfather of American indie cinema, a proper auteur whose Down by Law, Mystery Train and Coffee and Cigarettes cemented an entire genre of oddballs and American misfits muttering to themselves about the small details of their lives. So what the hell is he doing making a zombie movie? In The Dead Don't Die, Jarmusch lights out for George A. Romero territory with Chloe Sevigny, Bill Murray and Adam Driver as small-town cops, Tilda Swinton as a samurai funeral home director, because why not, and a parade of cameos. Is it any good? Here's a taster.
Is our plan to inform people about the zombie danger before it gets dark?
I guess so.
Because we passed Farmer Miller's place a little while ago. Do we need to inform him?
Fuck Farmer Miller.
Oh, okay.
Oh, my. Are you in this together?
So how the fuck do you kill a zombie?
Slow down a second, Cliff. Excuse me. You gotta kill the head.
Kill the head.
Decapitate. It's the only way to kill. Jesus.
We gotta get prepared.
Oh, that's bad. Yuck.
That's unfortunate.
She's alive?
Holy shit.
Look out, kids. The dead don't die.
I got this, Cliff.
Matt Glasby, you're a film chap. Where does Jarmusch fit in? I sometimes suspect, a director more admired than watched.
Yes, I mean, he's very admired, and the people that love him really love him. It's fair to say he probably hasn't troubled the mainstream too much. It's possible to go your entire film life without seeing any of his films, but his last release, The Only Lovers Left Alive, was absolutely beautiful, and about vampires with Tilda Swinton. And it's that thing that aims for cool and normally misses by so many miles. And actually, it felt really cool. It felt really cool. He really wanted to live through the night with them.
tell us, set up the Dead Don't Die for us. Tell us what's happening and what you thought of it as a cinematic achievement.
Well, okay, we're small town America. We've got Bill Murray and Adam Driver and Chloe Sevigny as cops, which is like the indie dream team. Mm. And the town is completely peopled by famous indie actors like Steve Buscemi, Iggy Pop turns up. You can sort of fill in the rest of your favourites.
Yes, the RZA is the UPS guy. Yes, WooPS, which I like.
Yes, that was...
There's Danny Glover's in there, Selena Gomez. I mean, it's a hell of a cast, what can I say? Mm. Anyway, there's a zombie outbreak, as we've seen many times before, and the cops have to deal with it, as we've seen many times before. And I've got to say, I wasn't a massive fan. Mm. I feel like... So it was going for kooky, it was going for funny, and it was going for a little bit of horror, which... before Shaun of the Dead might have seemed like an original combination, but that was 15 years ago, and there was Zombieland 10 years ago, and there was the entire flood of, oh, it's a little bit kooky, it's a comedy, there's gore. All these terrible films that came out after Shaun, Boy Eats Girl.
Better title than film.
A great title, but, you know, Samantha Mumba's acting. So we've seen this film many, many times before, yeah. So I don't know what Jim was thinking, oh, I'll bring some sparkle of indie dust to it. And also, it's a very half-hearted film. The thing, and I don't want to give any spoilers away, but at one point, Adam Driver and Bill Murray turn to each other and go, was that supposed to happen? And the other one says, it wasn't in the script that I read.
Yeah. Mm.
And the other one goes, oh, well, it was. You maybe didn't read the whole script. And then we're back to the movie, as if, oh, hang on, the whole 90 minutes you've just seen, it doesn't matter, they're just actors. And that's such a dangerous ground to be in. You have to announce that you're going to break this fourth wall and it's going to be fun. You can't just have people go, oh, yeah, talk about the script, because... why are we bothering believing in it?
If you're going to do that, then you really need to go balls out with it, don't you, and make it central to the movie.
I think they should have kept their balls in, to be honest. Yeah.
what I found really confusing about it was that the pace is incredibly slow, and you can do that, you know, and the focus on oddball characters is there, and that's totally, as you know, my limited experience of that's totally him. You know, I understand the kind of fascination of small-town America, but it's so slow and seems so lacking in... a reason to make this movie, anything, or it's looking, you know, stuck for anything to say apart from, well, America's a bit weird, isn't it? And I just found it so incredibly sort of frustrating and ultimately a little bit annoying, actually. And have you kept me here for an hour and a half, 2 hours to say what?
Well, one of the things that the zombies do is once they're in full flood is that they mutter the thing that they're after, like coffee or Xanax.
Or Wi-Fi.
Silly,
yeah.
Wi-Fi.
Bluetooth.
And, you think, OK, I get your point, Jim. But George A. Romero was saying this exact same thing in the mid-70s. He was saying they come back to the mall because that's what they know. And that seemed like a revolutionary sort of critique then. But now, I mean, is that really the best you've got for this film?
Well, the kind of... you know, the position of the George A. Romero zombie is that they are like an analogy to society, aren't they?
Right.
They are holding up a mirror to what we you know,
our
where
sickness,
we're going.
Yeah? Yeah.
Our own sickness, our own decay, our own obsessions with things in front of us. And he seemed to be completely stuck for anything to do with the zombie that was unusual, new, different, or in any way revelatory. They're just a load of special effects and the opportunity for a gag or two.
It did something else that really annoys. I'm a big horror film fan. There was a period in the 90s before the internet when horror films, they'd pepper the names of famous directors through the films. Mm. So, oh, that's Clive Barker, you know, the postman. And people that knew the genre would watch it and get like a little kind of Easter egg. But yeah. We're a bit late for that now because of the internet. So there's one moment that someone turns to another character and says, oh, I love your car, that's very George Romero. And you're like... wow, you've called attention to the guy that made these films. Sometimes 1969, is it? Night of the Living Dead, you know, like an age ago, and you're calling to attention. That's not funny.
You've called attention to something much, much better than what you... it's like a really bad rock record going, hey, the Beatles are great, aren't they? Anyway, moving on.
Desperate.
Rhoda, were you of a different opinion? Did you
no,
like it?
No, I wasn't of anything like a different opinion. I did actually swallow my pride, once again, cross a picket line, go into the Ritzy, but blimey, O'Reilly, what I just genuinely thought, oh, I'll never get that time back again.
Yeah.
And the only interesting thing, one thing made me laugh, which was when the kids said, eat me. Mm. I mean, and that's just because I like kids being, I like kids swearing or being rude. That made me laugh. It's the only time I laughed, I have to say. And then the sort of Tilda Swinton character. I mean, I like that because it was mad. But it was kind of sub... Any other sort of blonde woman with samurai swords remind you of anything? You know what I mean?
It's like... it was transplanted from any one of a dozen kind of cult movies.
Yeah.
And I was perfectly happy with that because I thought it was going somewhere. But without, again, without spoilers, you know, Movies like this rest on how we're going to explain all the stuff that's happened before. And apart from quite a good gag about polar fracking, bringing the dead back to life, the film just ends.
It didn't go anywhere with it.
Sean, what do you think?
Well, I have seen a couple of Jim Jarmusch films. I'm not an aficionado, but I know to expect not an amazing plot. Not lots of jump cuts, not lots of cross-processing. It's going to be quite slow. If you've seen Dead Man, things like that, they're very, very slow. And the start of the credits is just... It keeps coming up, obviously, with the cast. It's just a list of some cool people. You're thinking, you know, more and more. You think, God, another cool person. So I actually enjoyed it far more because I thought from the credits, God, another cool, you know, Chloe Savigny, all these people. It's a bit like Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure with Adam Driver being the indie Keanu Reeves, isn't it?
No, but movie Adam, that
yes, but that's what they're going for. He's the comedy, isn't he? And Adam Driver is the thing that is driving it. He's got the funnier lines. I went to Mexico. You know, I really like Mexico. I've been there twice or whatever he says. And he's always talking about it's going to end badly. I thought that was quite funny. I thought he was the one that was magnetic. There are points about it which are good and it's funny, but it's difficult when everything happens in films nowadays. Every other film has lots and lots of plot, and you've got something that is using these old tropes and trying to say something different, and we're really not sure what that is.
What I found, one bit I did find interesting and weird and possibly unintentional, was the fact that Chloe Savigny as the female cop is the only one who's genuine. Yeah, Mindy. Mm-hmm. She's the only one who's genuinely touched by the horror of what's going around. She's reacting to the fact that there are cannibalistic, living, dead, zombie revenants wandering around in Centerville. And everybody else is just completely blank on it. They might as well be zombies themselves. And I thought that was something that could have been a way to go.
There was something in that, because there's a sort of autism in the buddy movie that is between Bill Murray and Adam Driver. There's something interesting there. But yes, Jim Jarmusch just doesn't explore things. He just shows you. And you don't ever get it. And maybe this is what we need, is the depth behind that. Can we have the second draft of the script, please, Jim?
Yeah. Can someone else please go away and write the script?
I got a strong suspicion that the driving impulse behind this was Bill Murray and Adam Driver really fancied a cool zombie killing scene. It's just a great big sort of celebrity.
But you can't, if you have Deadpan and Deadpan, those are your two leads, both Deadpan. Yeah. It just looks like nobody cares.
It goes very flat. Mm. Also, there aren't enough zombies. Did you think the final scene, where is the final battle? We know what the final battle scene is.
Very easy to kill.
There's about 20 or something like that. There's none coming in the horizon. I thought, you couldn't employ it.
Do you think that last scene was a run out of money? Is that in the script moment? It takes an abrupt turn.
You need thousands.
I just thought, well, there's just not that much. It's small town America. They don't have many people.
I thought they might have got them. They're the dead. I mean, there's millions of them.
We're not running out of dead people. Make it more of them every day.
I was just grateful it was nearly over by that time.
For a change on the show, it's not often we strongly recommend people not to go and see something.
At
least I'm still of the ilk of, at least he's up there having a go.
I don't think he is having a go here. I think it's lazy. If you have seen it, though, I've got to say, I thought the resolution of the Tilda Swinton ninja funeral director plotline was one of the most insultingly stupid things I've ever seen.
Yes, that wasn't very clever, was it?
Like, really? That's your idea? Anyway, that's the end of the show on a massive downer. Let's finish it on a happier one with closing time chatter. What will our guests be discussing over a Lucozade and a couple of Dennis the Menaces in a disused carpet factory somewhere near Colville in Leicester? Rhoda, what's your closing time chatter for the show?
It's Coville, actually, not Colville. Anyway, my closing time chatter is about the fact that we had the Cricket World Cup. I mean, the men won... Cricket World Cup. We've won it 5 times now. Women have won it 4 times. Men have just won it once. But, you know, let's just not concentrate on that. No, it's the notion of having big sporting events, mostly on pay-per-view TV. And I just think that disconnects people from the whole experience. I'm really not a fan of big sporting events being behind paywalls. I think it's a real shame, because you have to go and search. You have to be in search of them, because when they actually put it on terrestrial TV for the final, so many more people tuned in. And if you're actually trying to, you know, sort of peddle sport as a way out of the nation's obsession with sugar and not getting any exercise, you have to make those available. So I think all sport. I would rather see big sporting occasions all be available on terrestrial TV. But, I mean, I suppose Sky have helped fund football and things. I don't really care about football, so that's fine. But because football will be fine anyway, and it's not because I don't care about football, it's just because I don't care about the notion of football will be fine. It's all the other sports that just don't get a look in.
It was interesting to see that a lot of the papers have started saying England men won the World Cup. Previously, they would have said England won the World Cup. Now they've started to say England men.
Well, they have to.
So there's a bit of a change. Yeah.
Well, they have to, because women have already won it four times. This is their first.
There you go. That's happened with the football as well. Matt Glasby, what's your closing time chatter?
Well, it's about a true crime author called Paul Harrison, who this week, he's part of his mystique is that he's a Kettering detective that spoke to Ted Bundy and he spoke to Peter Sutcliffe and he was there at Reggie Cray's deathbed. Anyway, he's made quite a career for himself out of this true crime. And this week, and I don't want to impugn his good name, some of this has been cast doubt upon about whether effectively a man that's risen from Kettering police dog handler to a sort of behavioural profiler would have met the most famous serial killers of all time, would have received a deathbed confession from Reggie Cray, who wasn't famously into policemen. And he's obviously having a bad week, so I don't want to make his
nice
week
way to put
any
it
worse. But that people are just questioning whether this whole thing is exactly as it's been pitched.
And his book has been withdrawn from sale, is that
it
right?
It has been withdrawn from sale while the publisher sort of gets their head around exactly what's happening. He's saying there's been a lot of hyperbole, there's been a lot to live up to, I'm moving out of the limelight for now, and, you know, who can blame him?
So they're going to get in touch with Reggie Cray for confirmation, aren't they?
Well, we were saying earlier, this is the thing about a deathbed confession, is that it's a really great way to get an exclusive, because also it's a deathbed confession that someone you can't libel, because they're a lifelong criminal, and they're dead.
And so they can't come back and say that was off the record, can
no.
they?
No. And I don't know, so what doesn't make clear is the leap from police dog handler in Kettering to trusted FBI behavioural. And that's just what this man achieved in his career in that paint should be the point of the story rather than what was true and what was not, because that's a hell of a rise.
Absolutely. Sean, what's your closing time chatter for this week?
Well, would you believe it? There is a statue has been put up to Melania Trump in her hometown of Svenica in Slovenia. And it looks like, to all intents and purposes, a balsa wood statue made by a three-year-old. Maybe it is folk art or outsider art.
But maybe her husband did it.
I don't think it would have been so flattering. In a wonderful blue dress. She looks like she's almost made out of plasticine as well. And I salute it. I think it's wonderful. It looks amazing. She is holding her left hand. She hasn't even got a hand. It's just a blue bit. Above some sort of field full of potatoes or something like that, out into the wilderness. And it is the most wonderful thing. And maybe if we have more statues like this, it would sort of take that, it would be, you know, take people down a peg or two when they really may need it.
It's very, very naive art, isn't it?
It's folk art.
Either done by a little kid or by a total Turner Prize three-time winner.
I think it's the latter.
Basically, this is, we're looking at essence of Melania drilling in, you know, stripping away everything but the very core of her, you know, very Central European, you know, a creature of the woods, not a creature of the modern world. So a distillation of feminine power.
You have seen the picture, haven't you?
It's incredible. It looks like a toy that a kid was given in about 1820 and has been played with on a daily basis.
Or set fire to it, you know, when kids get a bit evil.
Or the kind of thing that is you make it in order to put a curse on somebody.
But so imagine if every country decided to do a Donald Trump statue in this kind of feel, and if we had some of the Tory party, maybe a Nigel Farage, it might work. These powerful people who
as listeners know, Sean has her own art outlet.
Why don't you make
a House of Commons in kind of Wicker Man style? You make little effigies of each MP that you can then either curse or bless and direct.
Consider it done.
Absolutely.
Do a chessboard with them all sitting on it.
Turner Prize.
Brilliant.
Turner Prize 2020.
Right, I'm off now. I'm going to go and do it.
She's going to go on retreat, on sabbatical, in fact. My closing time chatter is the rehabilitation of Florida Man.
Oh, in a really
long piece in the Washington Post. This is a brilliant, brilliant piece about the Florida man phenomenon. Not just brilliant because it's interesting, but I can't believe that it was so bloody long. If you're not familiar with the Florida man thing, It is the idea that every day there is another insane story which begins Florida Man. From Florida Man tries to pick up prostitute while driving special needs school bus to Florida Man tries to reclaim his croc from by wrestling an actual croc. All this kind of stuff. It's like the idea that Florida is a uniquely insane repository of American weirdness. And what this great story does is it points out that if you were to substitute the words homeless person with serious substance abuse problems, you would see that these stories are tragedies. They're not comical, you know. In the cruelty of the internet, the stories of Florida Man are shared all over the place. Oh, isn't it funny what these you know, deprived and unhappy people are up to? So the story kind of looks at people who are trying to reclaim the best of Florida Man about his refusal to conform, his ability to seize the day and do the crazy thing. You may have seen the famous picture of a guy in no shirt, no shoes, and just a big pair of shorts, headbanging and holding an American flag in the middle of Hurricane Matthew while Slayer's Raining Blood plays. And that is the best of Florida Man, to stand out in a hurricane, in your shorts, with the American flag, playing Slayer and refusing to be defeated by an actual hurricane. So we'll put this on the Facebook page for the show. It's really interesting on not just the madness of Florida, but also how people sort of accentuate and pick it out because it's a proxy, actually, for their feelings about poor people and minority people and people with drug issues.
But it's surrealism as well. So there's a game you play where you put your birth date in and then you put Florida Man in. And should I tell you what I got?
I
quite like Florida Man awarded a settlement after police mistake donut glaze for meth.
See, that's
I like that because that's surreal.
Well, actually, that appears in this story because, as the guy from the Washington Post, the reports for the Washington Post, says many increasingly Florida Man stories are turning out to be tales of miscarriages of justice. So this guy gets banged up for meth when he's actually,
and got money for it.
So it's a positive Florida Man story.
Justice.
So let's stand
justice
up.
For Florida Man,
and I'm sure Florida Woman deserves a bit of justice as
You're
well.
You're right to.
I'm gonna start googling Florida Woman and see what she's been up to. Anyway, that brings us all to the end of the show. Rhoda and Matt, thanks for coming in. Rhoda, where are you playing next? Have you got stuff coming up?
I've got stuff coming up. Where am I playing next? I'm DJing at Broadcast in Glasgow on the 27th of this month. And then I think next month I'm not doing much till the end of the month when I'm in Germany. And I've forgotten the name of the place because it's like really tiny place in the east, which I've near Jena.
Well, I'm sure our many German listeners will be able to Google that one up for themselves. Thanks for coming in. Matt, remind us what's happening with that talk about train spotting.
I'm playing the BFI with or without a Scottish accent on Monday the 22nd.
Go on, do it.
I'll be introducing train spotting on the big screen. So, I mean, if you haven't seen it on the big screen, this is your chance. And only 10 minutes of me beforehand, so enjoy the film, basically.
Fantastic. Listeners, thanks for listening. Remember, we're off next week because it's Halls back in 2 weeks' time. So in the meantime, from me and Sean and producer Sophie, thanks for listening and we'll see you next time.
Good night, Rhoda.
Good night, Matt.